Whether or not you've read Homer's epic poem, The Iliad, chances are you've heard of Troy, well, the Trojan War, and you have some inkling of the historical gravitas of the place. Well, one of our guests this hour has the honor of leading a new expedition to excavate Troy in 2013, and we're also joined by an author who's reimagined the story of Achilles and his life and death during the legendary Trojan War. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guests this hour are William Aylward. He's an archaeologist and classics professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he'll be leading the upcoming expedition to Troy in 2013. And also joining us, Madeline Miller, the author of The Song of Achilles, which won the Orange Prize for Fiction in 2012. And we'd love to hear your questions and your comments about Troy this hour. If you're trying to separate fact from fiction and find out what we do know, you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And William Aylward, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
And Madeline Miller, pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
And you're in a hotel in India. Am I right about that?
Yes, I am.
So we've got the near and the far here, all talking about Troy. That's great. Well, now, in some respects, the two of you are at opposite ends of the spectrum. William, you'll be literally digging in the dirt at Troy, as you've done for many summers, to find out what's real and what we know. And Madeline, you've mined the myths of the Trojan War for a new story to tell. But you're both, I'm guessing, in love with Troy at some level. William, what excited you most about getting to dig at Troy?
Well, Troy is an amazing archaeological site. It's a unique resource for cultural heritage. I had the first opportunity to go there, my first opportunity to go there in 1996 with the University of Cincinnati campaign. I was a graduate student pursuing my doctorate at the University of Cincinnati in the classics department there. And my advisor, Charles Brian Rose, invited me to join the expedition. And I've been going back ever since, every summer. And it's a vast archaeological site with almost 5,000 years of uninterrupted settlement history. Unlike other sites in Greece and Turkey, Troy's in the Republic of Turkey, it has layers of occupation from prehistory and Greek and Roman times. So it really offers a unique window into the civilizations of the past, and in particular, the inhabitants, the prehistoric inhabitants of the site that we connect with the legends of Homer.
Mm. And what about you, Madeline? What is your fascination with that area, with Troy?
Well, like William, it sort of goes back a long way. I originally fell in love with these myths when my mother used to read them to me as bedtime stories, actually. And I just, from that first moment of hearing the first line of the Iliad, you know, "Sing, goddess of the terrible rage of Achilles," I was completely hooked. Mm. I loved the fact that the characters felt so real and so flawed, that even though they were on this incredibly grand scale with gods and destiny and wars, that these felt like real people to me.
And one of the amazing things about Troy, I mean, it does, as you say, Madeline, it lives on so in our literature, in our imaginations. There have been Hollywood blockbusters recently about Troy. It hasn't gone away. But, William, only one-fifth of Troy has been excavated scientifically, which must leave a huge amount of room for discovery. Now, as an archaeologist, what would be the holy grail for you in terms of what you might find there?
Well, there are many, many things that we haven't found, that archaeologists haven't found at Troy. And if we were to find them, they would transform our understanding of the archaeological site and perhaps provide some way for us to make some headway to close the gap between myth and history. Among these discoveries, for example, might be some prehistoric writing from the archaeological site. We know that the contemporary kingdoms of the prehistoric era, the kingdoms of the Hittites and the Mycenaeans, had vast and sophisticated writing systems. Archaeologists have discovered archives of clay tablets with written documents on them, and we haven't found any such resource at Troy, but it certainly could be discovered. If we were to find some prehistoric writing from the age from the layers of Troy connected with the Homeric legends, for example, that would provide a very it would transform our understanding of the archaeological site. So that's just one among a number of important discoveries that could happen.
Yeah, I bet that would be pretty amazing for lots of people, including Madeline Miller, to find proof of the Trojan War. Because do we have proof of the Trojan War? Do we know? Obviously, it had seen violence over the years, but what about the Trojan War as told by Homer?
We know that the site was sacked throughout prehistoric times. The sack at the end of the Bronze Age, which is... If there is a destruction layer at Troy to be connected with the Homeric epics, then it belongs at the end of the Bronze Age, around 1200 BC or so. But we know that the city throughout the Bronze Age, the period roughly between 3000 and 1000 BC, that the city was sacked time and time again. So there's quite a lot of suggestions in the archaeological record that allow for a very easy connection to the Homeric tale.
And Madeline, let's get you in on this. Now, your novel retells the story of Achilles and his companion Patroclus. This is sort of the mythical side of what we know about Troy. We've been talking about what we've been finding in excavations, but what is your take on what happens to Achilles and his companion Patroclus during the Trojan War?
Well, I mean, I think that as I was approaching this story, as William knows and was saying, there sort of is a huge gap between what exists in the mythology and sort of what Homer says about Troy and what we might actually know or what might have actually happened. So as I was approaching this story, I was really thinking, you know, that you sort of have a crossroads that you come to. Am I going to sort of primarily follow the myth, or am I going to try and dig into the archaeological research and try and reconstruct an actual sort of daily life in Troy, in Greece, during this time period? And for me, because Homer was really my primary source, I knew that I wanted to go the direction of really taking Homer as my primary source. So that meant that the gods were all on the table, that there really is, you know, in my novel, there is a centaur who teaches Achilles and Patroclus, you know, everything they need to know to grow up to be young men in ancient Greece, as opposed to sort of a more realistic view. So I actually don't even really think of my novel as historical fiction. I think of it more like mythological fiction, because I was welcoming in those myths.
And when you hear about, you know, this expedition that William's going to be leading in 2013, are you hoping for evidence of some of what Homer's written about, or do you like that there is sort of this historical shroud of mystery over it all?
I think I would say both. I was very, my treat to myself when the book was finally published was actually to go to Troy and visit it and get to see it. So I've seen it in the last few years, and I was just completely, people had sort of said to me, oh, you know, as you said, it's only about 20% excavated or less. There's plenty of stuff still underground. You're not going to see very much there as kind of just a person coming in to look at it. But I have to say that the site held just enormous power. There's something about that place, as you said, it's been inhabited, you know, it was inhabited for 5,000 years. Such a sense of history to the place, even if it doesn't connect with, you know, Homer's Achilles, still an incredibly, incredibly exciting site.
Madeline says there's some power to it, William. Do you agree with that? When you're there, do you feel something special? You told me before we went on that you're leading this expedition in 2013, but you've been going there and working on different projects for about 16 summers. Is there some special power at Troy?
Well, there certainly is. Just standing before the walls of the prehistoric city, this is a massive construction. According to legend, Apollo and Poseidon contributed to the construction of the fortification walls. They're 12 feet thick, over 30 feet high, solid interlocking limestone masonry quarried from local quarries in the area around Troy. And this is a real unique and signature monument that helps us understand the identity of the Trojans, ancient Trojan culture. The walls were built over many, many generations, so we can imagine the sons and grandsons of the Trojans who may have had the names of some of the Trojan heroes we know from the Homeric stories, lending a hand in the construction of the walls. So the walls of Troy as we know them from Homer and as we know them from the archaeological site, really make the site special. But they're also, it's also important to call out the Greek and Roman occupation layers of the archaeological site after the sack at the end of the Bronze Age and the collapse of Bronze Age civilization in the Aegean world. Greek speakers re-inhabited the site in about the 8th century BC, and later on the city was colonized by Romans when they made advances into the Eastern Mediterranean world. And those inhabitants of the place recognized the legends of Troy. Homer was, of course, important for the education of every elite person in the ancient Greco-Roman world. And they called special attention to the legends, and Troy was a tourist attraction. Xerxes, the Persian general, visited the site. Alexander the Great visited the site when he went to attack, when he went in 334 BC to attack the Persians.
So they were there as tourists because this had place had a reputation?
They certainly wanted to visit the place to get to become closer, to get that connection with the heroic age, to forge some connection between themselves and the legends of Homer.
Wow. Oh, it's amazing. And Madeline, before we go any further, I wonder if we could give people a taste of your book, because it does have the feel of archaeology. I know you went with Homer, but it feels, as you read it, incredibly authentic. It's an incredibly moving book, and you can tell you've done your research and you're trying to really give the sense that you're there and that there's no sort of time distance. Would you read a bit for us?
Sure. The section I'm going to read is actually Achilles and Patroclus meet, because Patroclus, who's born a prince, as Achilles is, when he's very young, he accidentally kills another boy and is exiled from his kingdom. And he's basically taken in by Achilles as sort of a charity case. So in this section, the two boys are around 11 years old, and they've just become friends. Our friendship came all at once after that, like spring floods from the mountains. Before, the boys and I had imagined that his days were filled with princely instruction, statecraft, and spear. But I had long since learned the truth. Other than his lyre lessons and his drills, he had no instruction. One day we might go swimming, another we might climb trees. We made up games for ourselves of racing and tumbling. We would lie on the warm sand and say, "Guess what I'm thinking about?" The falcon we had seen from our window, the boy with the crooked front tooth, dinner. And as we swam or played or talked, a feeling would come. It was almost like fear in the way it filled me, rising in my chest. It was almost like tears in how swiftly it came. But it was neither of those, buoyant where they were heavy and bright where they were dull. I had known contentment before, brief snatches of time in which I pursued solitary pleasure, skipping stones or dicing or dreaming. But in truth, it had been less a presence than an absence, a laying aside of dread. My father was not near, nor boys. I was not hungry, nor tired, nor sick. This feeling was different. I found myself grinning until my cheeks hurt, my scalp prickling till I thought it might lift off my head. My tongue ran away from me, giddy with freedom. "This and this and this," I said to him. I did not have to fear that I spoke too much. I did not have to worry that I was too slender or too slow. This and this and this. I taught him how to skip stones, and he taught me how to carve wood. I could feel every nerve in my body, every brush of air against my skin. He played my mother's lyre, and I watched. When it was my turn to play, my fingers tangled in the strings, and the teacher despaired of me. I did not care. "Play again," I told him. And he played until I could barely see his fingers in the dark. I saw then how I had changed. I did not mind anymore that I lost when we raced, and I lost when we swam out to the rocks, and I lost when we tossed spears or skipped stones. For who can be ashamed to lose to such beauty? It was enough to watch him win, to see the soles of his feet flashing as they kicked up sand, or the rise and fall of his shoulders as he pulled through the salt. It was enough.
Oh, that was so beautiful. Thank you so much for reading that, Madeline. And just taste of the relationship, this beautiful, overwhelming relationship that forms the basis of your novel, The Song of Achilles. As we talk this hour about Troy, we have with us William Aylward, who's an archaeologist and classics professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who's leading the upcoming expedition to Troy in 2013. And we also just heard from Madeline Miller reading from her novel, The Song of Achilles, which won the Orange Prize for Fiction in 2012. Wondering about the fact and the fiction of Troy, and what is it that does exert such a hold so many years later? We've talked about how it's well and alive in books like Madeline's, in films, and obviously in the scientific world, there's a lot of interest in Troy, a lot yet to be discovered. What do you want to know about Troy? What are your most burning questions? And if you've been there, what are your impressions? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you today. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And this hour, we're talking Troy. We've got with us William Aylward, who is an archaeologist and classics professor at the UW-Madison. He's also leading the upcoming expedition to Troy in 2013. And also joining us, Madeline Miller. She's the author of The Song of Achilles, which won the Orange Prize for Fiction in 2012. And I know, William, we talked a little bit about some of the things that your expedition is going to be doing differently. I gather there's an emphasis on molecular archaeology that's going to be happening at this new expedition. Tell us what that is and how it's going to work.
Well, molecular archaeology opens windows on new research questions about our human past. It allows for a study of evolution at the molecular level over an unlimited timescale. It promises profound impact on our understanding of the evolution of the human genome, the spread of humans, animals, plants, and bacteria across the Earth. The molecular history of domesticated plants and animals is another one of our research questions, and the origins and evolution of pathogens in ancient urban communities. Molecular archaeology allows the past to inform the present. You know, there's a robotic mass spectrometric laboratory on Mars right now, and that's investigating the history of that planet. We can use similar techniques to investigate the history of archaeological sites like Troy. I'm very fortunate to have as a collaborator Professor Michael Sussman from the Biotechnology Center, and we've joined forces with a new molecular archaeology group here on campus, drawing on the talent and resources from a number of departments, humanities and sciences combined, to take a look at this archaeological site of Troy. We have now unique access to this archaeological site. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and with a special collaboration that we have negotiated and managed with the Ministry of Culture and Tourism in Turkey. Of course, we operate in Turkey under their auspices and with their cooperation, so we're very grateful for their invitation to us, and also with my colleague Rustem Aslan at Çanakkale Önseki Smart University, we have the chance to collaborate and approach the archaeological site of Troy as a scientific laboratory for new directions in archaeological science.
Oh, sounds amazing. I can't wait to find out what you find out. For instance, I know you were saying with some of the technology, we might be able to know what Trojans ate for dinner.
That's correct. Dr. Greg Barrett-Wilt is director of the mass spectrometry facility at the Biotechnology Center. He joined us at Troy in 2012. We were able to begin some pilot studies looking at chemical residue on ancient cooking vessels, drinking vessels, tableware that was used by the ancient Trojans and later Greek and Roman inhabitants of the site. And those specimens are now being studied at the Biotechnology Center. So we hope that they'll shed some light on the lifeways of the ancient Trojans.
Incredible, yeah. All right, well, let's go to our first phone call now. We've got Nancy, who's joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. Many years ago, I read a fictionalized version of Schliemann's life. And then later, many, many years later, I read that all of his work is really more or less discounted by professional people. Do you find that to be true?
And we should say first who Schliemann is, right? You want to tell us, William?
Sure. Heinrich Schliemann probably first went to Troy in the very late 1860s. He was a self-made millionaire. He struck it rich in the California Gold Rush in the 1850s. And later retired and sought to prove the historicity of the Trojan War. One of his childhood fascinations with Homer. He wanted to live it out. He visited the archaeological site with the Iliad in one hand and a shovel in the other hand, and sought to try to prove the historicity of the Trojan War. He sensationalized the excavations there between 1870 and 1890. He drew the first worldwide attention to the archaeological site. He built on the discoveries of Frank Calvert, who had been there before him, and who doesn't really get any credit for his work that he did at the site. Schliemann made all of these contributions. He's a very important character for archaeology because he forced a conversation about archaeology as a scientific discipline, and his diaries are very, very meticulous, and the contributions that he made to archaeology as a science are very, very significant. At the same time, it's probably true that many of the tales that are told and the documents that are included in some of his journals may be suspect.
Mm. Well, it's interesting. So he went with an agenda, which is something you shouldn't do as an archaeologist. You should see what the dig site offers up instead of having, I guess, your own ideas about it, for one thing. Do you have any cherished, you know, hopes for it going in, even knowing that you shouldn't have them? Would you like to see that great big wooden horse sticking out of the dirt?
Well, I think that the gap between myth and archaeology is an important one, and that's the reason why Troy has endured as an attraction for all of Western art and literature over really 3,000 years since the Homeric poems, first oral stories, were committed to text about 800 BC. And that's an important gap, and we should respect that gap and understand that that's the reason why we continue to go back to the legends of Troy, why every generation has its own adaptation and readaptation of this important story, which includes exemplars like Achilles and Helen and Hector and King Priam for human experience.
And Madeline, we just heard William calling the Iliad an important story, which of course it is, but why do you think it is so important? Why do you think it's had such resonance over the years, you know, that there you are in 2012 winning an award for writing about the Trojan War and Achilles?
Well, I think that I often teach these myths in the classroom and teach Homer, and I'm always really taken anew by how incredibly gripping my students find it. That, you know, they kind of go into it thinking, oh, this is, you know, 3,000 years old, or, you know, and it's just not going to be that interesting. And they're just pulled right into the story. But I think that Homer, or whoever it was who composed these poems, was just incredibly insightful about human nature, and that in the Iliad and the Odyssey and other ancient literature, you just see all of kind of the same virtues and vices that we still struggle with today. You know, war and desire and family loyalty and, you know, anger, pride, all these things are just so beautifully, beautifully present in these works, with no answer, really, just kind of presenting them.
And what about the time capsule element that you really get, you know, the flavor of that time period? Is that part of it?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, it's also incredibly compelling, and Homer does a wonderful job of making you feel like you're there on the battlefield. I mean, he really doesn't hold back. You know, if you're reading the Iliad in Greek for the first time, you learn all the vocabulary for the internal organs, because it's constantly, you know, someone's splattering, their brain is splattering, you know, their spleen, it's just, there's blood and guts and sort of that visceral sense of really being there that I think puts you in that moment.
Wonderful. Well, let's go to another call now. We've got Tom, who's on the line from Winona, Minnesota. Hey, Tom.
Yes. In 1981, I was fortunate enough to visit Mycenae in Greece. And at that time, the guides told us about Schliemann and the possibility that Mycenae may have been Troy, and that even though the water had receded miles away, that they were trying to come up with some arguments on how the water, there, because of the shifting of the earth, earthquakes or whatever, that the water had receded. But I was curious about the connection between Mycenae and Troy.
Well, Mycenae is another important archaeological site in Greece in the area called the Argolid. It's inhabited at the same time that Troy is inhabited. Each prehistoric citadel rises to power about 1500 BC or so, Mycenae is at the center of an expanding Mycenaean empire, and this competition for resources in the Aegean probably is one of the causes for the conflict that results in the destruction of Troy. We know that Troy was much closer to the sea in prehistory than it is today. If you visit the site today, Troy's about 5 kilometers from the Aegean coastline, but we know from a series of geomorphological analyses in the plain at Troy over the past 20 years and a reconstruction of the prehistoric topography through these geomorphological analyses that Troy was much closer to the sea in prehistory. In fact, at the time of the very first fortress, which we call Troy I, about 3000 BC, Troy was probably right on the coastline, and that was very important for the citadel's control over the Hellespont, which was the only maritime waterway connecting the Black Sea and the Mediterranean, and therefore of profound consequence for military security, maritime trade in the ancient world.
And so if the shore was closer, I guess that would make that Trojan War scene a little more possible with 1,000 Greek ships up there on the shore. Madeline, did you picture this battle when you were there, when you visited Troy? Were you able to, in your imagination, see what Homer saw?
Well, yes and no. As William said, I think the gap between mythology and sort of reality is important. So on one level, here I was standing on kind of the highest point of the site, which I believe dates back to, you know, supposedly, you know, the same time that the Trojan War is usually assigned to, and looking at and realizing how much closer the sea would have been. And of course, now suddenly it makes so much sense why the Greeks want to build that giant palisade wall, not only to defend the beachhead where they were, but also because the Trojans could look right in. And so, you know, that it was right there. So that it was moments like that were really incredibly exciting. But at the same time, you know, I was very aware that you know, if someone were really going to press me on it, I'm not sure I believe that Achilles ever really lived. But I don't think that makes him any less of a powerful figure. I mean, I think it's a testament to Homer's creation that whether or not he was real is sort of beside the point. Mm-hmm. That in Homer's imagination, he was able to build this city, you know, win the Ilion, and he was able to populate it with these intensely powerful and gripping characters.
And another call now. Let's go to Carl. Carl is joining us from Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Carl.
Hey, very interesting. I'm investigating some of the history of language. You're looking at the very foundations of our language. Is it true there was graffiti in the city of Pompeii that said, I love the one whose name is this number? I believe there was some common usage of an alphanumerical system. They were microprocessing letters to make names for everything. The beginning of science and calculus, the history of our belief systems written there. So can you suggest any other modern sources of translation updating? I'm doing stuff like CFVI, as in Roman numeral, is used as to be F and is written as 6. And so, and who was Helen? And is that the writs of Hellenism. Did they make the word elementary or element?
Sounds like a lot of technical questions about language there. Can you take a whack at that, William?
Well, I'm not a linguist, but I'm not sure about the graffito to which you're referring from Pompeii. But we know that that numbers and language and numerology, these things were central to ancient Greco-Roman society, and they helped to provide a system of order by which the ancients were able to understand the universe and the cosmos.
And Madeline, you teach Greek and Latin, right? Do you have any insight?
I also don't know the particular graffito that he's referring to. I can certainly comment on the very salty graffiti that is all over the ancient Greco-Roman world.
Salty,
the Romans
huh?
In particular, were the saltiest had all kinds of things to say that they scrawled on the walls that now remains. So certainly, I think graffiti is always a fascinating way to look at a society.
Can you tell us something that's PG-13?
For example, on the kind of siege bullets that they were sending into a besieged town, the force that was being besieged was Antony's wife, whose name was Fulvia. And so some of the siege bullets, I hope this is PG-13, say something like, "Fulvia, sit on this." So that sort of thing.
That's funny. It sounds like something you might hear today, actually. Interesting. And I want to talk, if we could go back a little bit, you know, we were talking about how Homer's world is peopled with gods and goddesses. And William, I want to start with you. What do we know about the religion of the Trojans? Have you come across any temples or any indication about what the religious practices would have been, archaeological evidence?
Well, from Troy, we have quite a lot of evidence for the religious practices of the Greek and Roman inhabitants. On the Acropolis that was built by the Greek Hellenistic inhabitants of the city, there is a monumental marble temple to Athena Ilios, the patron deity of the city. And this was built in marble quarried from the island of Proconesus at the end of the 3rd century B.C. It's a monumental temple built in the Doric style. It was decorated with architectural sculpture that probably mimicked the artistic program one can see on the Parthenon in Athens. This was a way for the Greek inhabitants of the city of Ilion to promote their Hellenic identity. And we have other... And we know that the Romans, when they lived in the city, continued to promote that archaeological the cult of Athena Ilios, and there are other minor temple places around the archaeological site. So we do know quite a lot about the religion of the inhabitants of the place.
And I'm sure more to discover there as well. And Madeline, could you talk about a little how you chose to draw the gods and goddesses that show up in the Song of Achilles, your novel? For instance, Achilles' mother, Thetis, you draw her very in an otherworldly way. She's a sea nymph, and she's very strange. She's not exactly what I've seen before. How did you come across with the way you wanted to draw, for instance, Thetis?
Well, I knew I wanted her to be a very important part of the story, not only because she's Achilles' mother, but also because of how central the gods are to Homer's narratives. And so in creating her, I was really kind of trying to go back to ancient stories and think about, you know, how gods are presented in ancient literature. And there are a multiplicity of ways that they are presented. I mean, even in Homer, there isn't just one way. You know, the gods can be very terrifying, but they can also be almost comic, buffoonish at times. So it's interesting, you know, you get a lot of variety. But the stories that I was really drawing on is I wanted to represent the gods in their full kind of terrifying glory, that they really are, as compared to humans, frightening figures. And in particular, I'm sort of thinking of, you know, the classic story where Zeus reveals himself in his full glory to the mortal woman Semele, and she incinerates. And so that feeling of that when God is in their full power, it, for humans to be around them is uncomfortable, that they're alien. They're you know, so powerful that it's sort of hurts to be near them. So I was drawing on that. You know, a lot of times in ancient literature, you get descriptions of a god appears to a human, and afterwards the human's hairs are standing on end. They're just completely, you know, horrified, electrified, terrified. So I wanted that feeling. I wanted to really honor that. At the same time, I was very interested in the fact that Thetis, as a sea nymph, is really kind of low woman, low nymph on the totem pole, that within the system of the ancient gods, it's very hierarchical. And so you sort of have, you have Zeus at the top, very powerful, but then, you know, when you get to the level of nymphs, even though she's a goddess and she might be very frightening for a mortal to come across her, she actually isn't able to do very much for her son. And in the end, and this is sort of the tragedy of her story, she wants to save her son's life and she can't.
Well, it is a chilling portrait. It's a very striking portrait of a goddess. As we talk Troy this hour, our guests are William Aylward, archaeologist and classics professor at the UW-Madison, who is leading the upcoming expedition to Troy in 2013. Also joining us, Madeline Miller. She is the author of the Orange Prize-winning book, The Song of Achilles. And we're talking with both this hour about the myths and the facts of the city of Troy, the site of Troy. And we want to know your questions about Troy, and you can talk myth, you can talk archaeology. We've got someone who can talk to both angles there. What are you wanting to know about Troy? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And if you prefer, you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up tonight at 7 o'clock, it's On Point. We're looking at The Real Parent Trap at 7, Turning Into Your Parents. At 7 o'clock's On Point on Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we are talking Troy. We've got with us William Aylward, who is leading the upcoming expedition to Troy in 2013. He's an archaeologist from the UW-Madison. And Madeline Miller, who wrote the Orange Prize-winning novel, The Song of Achilles. And, William, I've read that one of the things as an archaeologist you get kind of excited about is coming across these sites, I guess basically like the garbage dumps of the town. What do you find there?
Well, anything that the ancient inhabitants of an archaeological site threw away is important to us. Here we can find, we can get quite a lot of information about diet, for example, or life ways of the ancients by examining the discarded bones of butchered animals from kitchens, broken cooking vessels, broken drinking vessels. When inhabitants of ancient urban centers threw things away, and this refuse just becomes buried in an alleyway or under street pavers or outside of a window, those types of discoveries are important to us because we can harness and have access to the sort of immediate information about what was happening inside of a house or a temple or a building. So it's what the ancients threw away. Those are the things that are most important to us.
Pay dirt, the garbage dump. Okay, well, let's go to John. John is on the line from Madison. Hi, John.
Hi. Between the destruction of Troy and Homer's creation of the Iliad and Odyssey, roughly 300 to 400 years transpired, and there were a couple civilizations, the Mycenaean, Hittite, etc., were destroyed. This was called an early Dark Age of Greece, and I just wondered if you had any definite thoughts about the Indo-Europeans that destroyed these two civilizations. Were they, was it like a Dorian invasion, or were there other multiple invasions during this 300 to 400 years? And also, I was reading recently that the Iliad and Odyssey were two separate tales, and they were only joined by Homer. Actually, the Odyssey was separate from the Iliad originally. I just wondered if you had any information about that.
Okay, great. Why don't we start with that last one first, Madeline?
Sure. Well, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey are sort of, well, you mentioned this, were you know, foundational texts in the ancient world. I mean, everyone read them. They were, you know, really building blocks of the culture. But they were not the only epics stories that existed during this time. And in fact, there were many, many epic cycles that covered, the Iliad really just covers a very short period of time. The last year of the Trojan War kind of starts with a big blowout fight between Achilles and Agamemnon, the two important Greek princes, and then ends with the funeral of Hector, Prince of Troy. And then the Odyssey picks up with Odysseus' journey home. So what's amazing is that the story of the, you know, Trojan horse, which is so famous, is not covered in either of those. In terms of chronology, it's kind of looked back on in the Odyssey, the fall of Troy. So there were all these other epics that were around as well. And the Iliad and the Odyssey are the ones that have come down to us. They were the most famous. They're the ones that have been preserved. But they certainly are two separate poems, and I would say that actually they have a very different character to them. I find the Iliad a much more cynical piece in many ways than the Odyssey. Hmm. It's interesting to kind of look at the reception of these two poems throughout history and to see that at different times in history it's been kind of an Iliad moment or an Odyssey moment. And I really feel like we're in an Iliad moment right now.
Interesting.
People are really looking to it. So I really see them as sort of separate poems.
Any chance you'll be writing about Odysseus's return home next, Madeline?
Yes, actually.
Uh-huh.
Odysseus was initially one of the characters I was most intimidated to sort of tackle. He has such a storied history in literature, but I came to really enjoy him as a character, and I would love to finish his story, and I'd also like to give a chance for some of the dynamite heroines of the Odyssey to have a chance to speak.
So. Well, you've definitely set it up well, the hero who loves his wife and can't wait to get home. So it'll be an interesting book. And William, can you answer some of the historical questions there that we had?
Well, sure. Let me start with Carl Blagan from the University of Cincinnati. He led a campaign to Troy in the 1930s and discovered and published some of the best deposits found at Troy to date, which show that the city was attacked at the end of the Bronze Age by human agents. In other words, not destruction by earthquake, which we know happened at different periods in the city's history. And one of the remaining research questions about these deposits is the identity of the attackers. This question has not been really resolved yet. So the caller mentioned Indo-European invaders, the question of a Dorian invasion. The Dorian invasion pertains more to the mainland of Greece and the destruction of places like Mycenae and Tiryns and Thebes and other palaces at the end of the Bronze Age. But to date, we still don't know the identity of the attackers at Troy at the end of the Bronze Age. Other theories involve the sea peoples, a mysterious people from the sea recorded in documents found in Egypt. And this continues to bring archaeologists back to these archaeological sites in the Aegean world. This is one of the enduring research questions that remains to be answered.
Mm. And William, having spent so much time at the site of Troy, do you have a sense whether this would seem like an alien culture to us, or might we have more in common, you know, with ancient Trojans than we think we do?
We think we have a lot in common with the civilization of the ancient Aegean, prehistoric civilizations and Greek and Roman civilization, but probably we have less in common than we are led to believe. Mm-hmm. We look around us and we see neoclassical architecture with reflections of the Doric style and the Ionic style. For example, there are many, many examples in modern culture with reflections of the past. But if one were to be magically transported back into the age of prehistoric Troy or even Greco-Roman times, it would be an alien civilization, and we would be shocked.
I don't know if I'm disappointed by that. Go ahead, Madeline.
No, I was going to say I agree. I mean, I think attending a sacrifice of 100, you know, bulls would be an alarming and different experience. That, you know, we look for the similarities, but it's true that there were, you know, shocking differences.
Can you think of any others, Madeline, that might surprise us?
Well, I think it also depends what time period, you know, you're talking about. But one of the kind of classic examples of speaking of sacrifice would be, the moments of human sacrifice are quite rare and frowned upon in the mythology, but they do happen. Agamemnon sacrifices his daughter, Iphigenia. You have the sacrifice of the princess Polyxena, the Trojan princess Polyxena, to the ghost of Achilles. And so certainly moments like that, even though they were kind of, they're frowned on in the mythology and the characters kind of suffer consequences for them, even the fact that they did exist enough to be part of the story, I think would also have been quite shocking.
Different moral code, for sure. Okay, let's go to another phone call. Mark is joining us in New Glarus. Hi, Mark.
Hi. This is, I suppose, a molecular geology question, but I'm just wondering about the food supplies during multiple year sieges and how far, food came in and how the whole logistics behind food supplies for tens of thousands of men.
Excellent question. Thanks for asking it. From the perspective of the Trojans behind the fortress walls, the estimated population of the citadel at the end of the Bronze Age is about 5,000 people or so. That may have included inhabitation of a lower town, only discovered in the 1990s with a program of geomagnetometry. But we know that the citadel, behind the fortress walls, there were robust groundwater wells, which provided ready access to water. And we know that, especially at the very end of the Bronze Age, the Trojans were well equipped with food storage facilities inside the walls. Now, from the perspective of an attacking force, of course, the Homeric stories suggest a protracted siege, many years long. And of course, archaeologically, we have no evidence for such a protracted siege. But we know that there were villages and towns in the landscape, farms and fields and farmsteads, and these types of supplies were ready to be taken by attacking forces. For example, when Xerxes, this is from the historical period, but it's an important example. When Xerxes, the Persian general, was on his way to invade Greece, before he crossed the Hellespont on pontoons, stopped at Troy, and we are told by Herodotus, the Greek historian in the 5th century BC, we are told that he sacrificed 1,000 cattle. And he didn't bring those along with him. He drew them from the local territory. Those belonged to the inhabitants of Ilion in the 5th century BC. And those were used to feed the army on his way to invade Greece.
1,000 cattle. You can imagine that didn't go over too well with the owners of the cattle. And Madeline, I can't remember, what were your imaginings of what would have sustained these armies during the Trojan War?
And again, here is kind of the difference between myth and reality. The ancients were fond of large numbers, that were often very impressive. So William talked about how, there's no evidence for a very long siege, and I think it's pretty common for sort of the idea of the 10-year long siege to just mean it felt really long. or sort of the time had 50 sons. Well, he had several sons. The idea of kind of these inflationary, that's part of the epic grandiosity, is you kind of have these very large numbers, and then, it's sort of understood that we're in the realm of epic. But, as I was thinking about this, this is sort of where kind of the rubber meets the road when you're writing a mythological fiction, because you want to kind of follow Homer, but you also want to be in the world of plausibility, even if it wasn't how it actually rolled out. So I was looking at the fact that there would have been a number of, there would have been all kinds of farms all around that area, that the Greeks would have been, of course, raiding, and they would have been, going out on raids to kind of the civilizations in the Troad all around, and taking stuff from them as well. So I was thinking about the mechanics on both sides. How are the Greeks sustaining their forces? How are the Trojans getting getting their stuff. And of course, in Homer, Troy is an incredibly rich city, and it has a lot of, you know, many neighbors and sort of a lot of communication with those neighbors. So I assume that they were also drawing somewhat on their allies to sustain them.
And we're out of time, but I want to thank you both so much. It's been a great hour. So much to think about here. Thank you, William.
Thank you.
And thank you, Madeline, for joining us from India.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to join you.
William Aylward is an archaeologist. He's going to be leading the upcoming expedition to Troy in 2013. And Madeline Miller is the author of The Song of Achilles, which won the Orange Prize for Fiction in 2012. Thank you to Rhonda Fanning. She produced this hour's programs. And thanks to Rob Ferret, who answered your phone calls today. Kathleen Dunn is going to be out all week, and I will be here. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.